This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome. I'm Lucas Rappel, and today I'm speaking with Mark Hetzel. Working with a group of over 50 students at the Little Wound School in Kyle, South Dakota, Mark collected countless hours of oral history interviews with Ogallala Lakota people on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Mark and his students then turned those interviews into a 7-part audio series to piece together the long and complex story of the Lakota Oyate, or Nation, through the voices of local elders and community members. These are now available in the form of a podcast called The Heart of All Oral History Project. As Mark's students write on The Heart of All's website, quote, "We see this project as an opportunity to finally tell our own story, to set the record straight, and to be reminded by our own relatives where we came from and who we really are," end quote. Framed as a conversation between community elders and students at the Little Wound School, the podcast series reflects the oral storytelling tradition that represents how Lakota people traditionally passed their knowledge on from one generation to the next. But this process was interrupted by the U.S. federal government's assimilationist policies during the late 19th and early 20th century, which punished Lakota people for speaking their language or practicing their traditional culture and ceremonies in boarding schools as well as other institutions of settler colonialism. By providing a space for Lakota people to tell their own history in their own voices, this project thus represents a profound statement of indigenous sovereignty and Lakota resistance to the epistemic imperialism of the United States. It's also a rich resource for non-Native people who are interested in learning more about the violent history of settler colonialism, the immense courage and steadfast resilience of Lakota people, as well as the beauty, creativity, and humor of Lakota culture. I simply can't say enough good things about this eye-opening series. The stories are beautifully told, and the whole thing is deeply researched. It's also an incredibly moving account of a history whose importance cannot be overstated, but one that non-Native audiences seldom hear told from an Indigenous perspective. So I just can't recommend it highly enough. If you want to learn more about the Heart of All Oral History Project, please visit www.heartofalohp.com. So that's one word, www.heartofalohp.com. Welcome, Mark.
Good to see you hear your voice. Lucas, it's been a while. Last time I saw you was in Kyle, South Dakota, and I'm happy that our paths have crossed and continue to.
Yeah, me too. Now you're in Chicago, I understand it, or nearby at least. Can you tell us a little bit, though, about how it was that you initially came to live in Kyle, South Dakota, where I understand you lived for quite a few years?
Yeah, I was actually living in Chicago for a number of years, close to 20, I think. And I realized, I guess, that I needed a change. I was kind of tired of every time I went outside running into people and traffic and kind of claustrophobic and like, maybe going through something in my life. I forget, but kind of needed a change. And so I looked for opportunities to, for some reason, I was always drawn to South Dakota and interested in the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And so I reached out to a friend who I knew had done some work out there and asked for, you know, some tips and how I could get out there and get involved. And she made some suggestions. And so I went out there and really fell in love with the place. I met a man named Ed Youngman, afraid of his horses, and really kind, generous man, really important part of the Little Wound School community. And when I went back to Chicago, I just thought about this place that, you know, resonated with me so deeply and tried to figure out a way that I could get back over there. And so I found out that Teach for America was an integral part of Little Wound School. And that was a way that I could kind of make my way into the community. And I everything kind of just fell into place. I applied to Teach for America, and I subverted the process and found elected the school that I wanted to there anyway, ended up at the school I wanted to be rather than the way that the process normally works and stuff like that. So I figured out how to get there. And 2 weeks after I arrived, Ed Youngman, afraid of his horses, actually passed. And so I lost the only person that I knew in Kyle. And but anyway, I had already met some of his friends and stayed in touch with them. And after a year passed, we started an Ipi ceremony, or the sweat lodge ceremony, as most people know it, back up, something that he had done a couple times a week for I don't know how many years. But and so I got to know his friends really well. And I was just in awe every time we would come out of an Ipi and we'd sit around and eat and talk, and the stories, the history, the, you know, the humor, all of these things were so charming isn't the right word, but it was just incredible to hear. And then I contrasted that with my experience at the school, where a lot of students that I had been working with for several years by then didn't have any understanding of a lot of this history, or, you know, weren't getting these teachings at home and stuff like that. And so I realized that, you know, something like this project would be really important for future, for these kids I was working with that weren't getting those teachings, and for future generations. And so it kind of precipitated, you know, applying for grants and stuff like that, and then everything kind of fell into place again.
Yeah. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about, you mentioned a project, so can you just tell us a bit more about what the Heart of All Oral History Project was? And it sounds like, yeah, it grew out of your friendship with Young Man Afraid of His Horses and his friends, and doing sweat lodge ceremonies with them. So can you just talk a little bit about how you started collecting oral histories and how you became interested in doing that kind of work and turning it into a podcast series at some point?
Yeah. So, you know, there was one man that I knew through Ed. His name was Marcel Bulbert, and he was probably the first person that actually kind of challenged me, you know, we need to do something, he said, and with his sparkle in his eye. I took it as a challenge, and knowing, you know, that what I just explained, you know, the importance of this stuff and how important it was for the students, for not just students, even a lot of adults. There were so many processes, you know, boarding schools, the generation that came after boarding school survivors, a lot of those teachings were lost through a lot of the historical processes that we cover in the project. So it just seemed like something that needed to be done. I don't know if I addressed your question directly. Do you have any follow-up question?
Well, I guess, I mean, one basic question I have for you is the role of oral storytelling in Lakota historiography, you might say. So like the way that Lakota people themselves pass their history from one generation to the next, the role that oral storytelling play, if you could talk a little bit about oral storytelling as an important mode of transmitting historical knowledge from one generation to the next, and how that influenced your decision to present Lakota history through conversations with Lakota elders. So how you decided that kind of oral history is a good way of representing Lakota history, given the importance of storytelling within the Lakota community itself.
Yeah. So, you know, the Lakota language, I think, you know, it wasn't written until very recently, the last probably, I don't know, I would say, I don't know exactly, around 100 years or so, maybe a little bit more. And so, yeah, prior to that, to being converted into the English language, and that's become a whole challenging topic today, but that's how everything was passed on: knowledge, history, culture, you know. And so we it was a no-brainer that this is how we were going to go about it. You know, a lot of people wanted us to turn it into a book, or you know, and it was like, well, that's, you know. And again, I was boggled when I started out working in Kyle at Little One School. I worked with ninth graders, and there were some incredible books that I would read to the students, knowing that, you know, that about the oral tradition, and these are traditional stories, and they were just incredibly complex stories where myself, when I would be, there were so many different characters and so many convoluted story arcs intertwined and stuff like that, that I would have trouble. And I had read the pieces a couple times before before I presented them to students. And when I'd be presenting them to students, they would just so casually be sitting there, and, you know, and I was like, ninth graders, they're not paying attention. But I would ask them quite very, like, you know, intricate questions, and they were on it. Like, for there's something in them that it just worked. Like they were getting it. They were getting the stories. It was like almost in their DNA or in their blood or something, you know. And so that's why I thought this would be such a important way to go forward with this project. And I've had some people ask me to, you know, transcribe the whole thing, which would be by the end of it, it's 11 hours and 47 minutes of audio with the narration and then the actual interviews themselves and that type of thing. So that would be, for one thing, a huge undertaking. But secondly, it's not meant to be read, you know, it's meant to be heard.
Yeah, so it kind of taps into this very traditional ancient art, you could say, of Lakota storytelling, that's an amazing story about your students, how they're just so good at listening. And actually, that's something I've thought about a lot too, that like, for many of us, that's really something that we have to learn how to do, right? Like listening, it turns out, is really hard to do. And it's an important, yeah, it's a really amazing part of Lakota culture. I was wondering if you could just also, it was really interesting to hear you talk about your students and how in many ways they kind of shaped your own understanding of Lakota culture and your experience in Kyle on the Pine Ridge Reservation. So I was wondering if you could, and it reminded me that, of course, your students play such an important role in the podcast series that you produced, the Heart of All Oral History Project as well. So the students are kind of really central characters in a way in the podcast. So if you could talk a little bit about the role that students played in the podcast and why you thought it was so important to include your students in the kind of, you know, when listeners hear the podcast, they can hear your students' voices, why that's so important, not just to hear from community elders, but also to hear from young people and, you know, young Lakota people as well.
Yeah, I thought, you know, if I hoped, you know, which I did, I hoped that students, other kids, my students' age or old, you know, down the road, future generations would want to listen to this, that they would be more likely to do so if they heard somebody their own age, you know, presenting the information. So that was definitely one aspect of it. And then, you know, I'm not working there anymore, so I say have, but they have such an incredible instinct about it. And, you know, hearing stuff that I would this happened during we started the project and then COVID happened. And so a lot of the interviews I had to do on my own, you know, because of the challenges of COVID. And so I would bring them to the students. I would then bring the interviews to the students so they would listen to the entireties of the interviews. And they just had such an instinct about what was interesting and what, and we had such great conversations about, you know, what other people would want to hear and why it was important and, you know, the knowledge that needed to be passed on. So that's what, you know, a lot of that, that's a big part of why the students' voices were at the forefront of the project and their input was so valued. And so, you know, they really guided me as to like the protocol we would use even as when we approached or, you know, because of COVID, when I approached elders, like how we should proceed. You know, and they suggested going back to traditional protocols that we bring them tobacco, we bring the elders tobacco as an offering, which is something that you do in Lakota culture. If you're looking for advice or if you're looking for somebody to share information with you. So, and, or food when that was possible, when I'd be meeting people face to face or, you know, when things loosened up a little bit, related to COVID. So they guided me with the protocol, how we should approach the whole thing. Again, they told me what was important, that should be passed on and preserved from each of those interviews, which led me to a lot of editing, which became my life for the better part of 3 years. And let's see, what else did they do? They, helped with the narration. They helped me write the narration and then read the narration. And this was something that was, if you hear it, by the end of 12 episodes, I think the narration script was close to 60 pages, typed pages with 130 or 40 footnotes. And we did a lot of research and they helped me with the narration and they read it. And that was really interesting process getting them, you know, a lot of rehearsal and that type of, and they took it so seriously. It was really wonderful to watch how invested they were in it. They also helped me networking. So we reached out to some organizations around the state. South Dakota is a very conservative state. And especially for, there's a lot of racism to this day against indigenous populations when you leave the reservation, and we could get into that. But anyway, they guided me in how to reach out to organizations that might bolster our efforts, and they helped me with the social media campaign. They just so many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just speaking for myself, I have to let you know that when I was listening to the series, and it is very long, it took me a lot, although it was actually really nice for me because, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, I met you when I visited, Kyle. And so I was have been spending a lot of time driving around South Dakota and driving from Rapid City to Pine Ridge and Rosebud and other parts of other reservations in South Dakota and listening to the oral history podcast while driving around in these areas where the history takes place was both really informative for me to kind of get up to speed on the history. It was super helpful, but also kind of really helped put me in a kind of cultural context. It was And for that, like hearing that dialogue between the community elders and the children, your students at Little Wound School, I found just incredibly effective because I could just kind of imagine this as a conversation between generations and just kind of hear the knowledge being transmitted from one generation to the next. And then imagine these students growing old and at one point, you know, telling their children or telling other children these important stories and this important history. You mentioned something that I'm wondering if you want to elaborate about a little bit, which is the widespread racism against Lakota people and other indigenous people in South Dakota, but of course, all over the world, really. I mean, certainly elsewhere in the United States too. Have you had any thoughts about how this kind of oral history project and other oral history projects like it could, I don't know, what the relationship is maybe between like whether that can be useful to people outside of Pine Ridge as well, whether you're hoping that white people will listen to this podcast too and what they might take away from this knowledge that's being communicated?
Yeah, so the governor of South Dakota, and one of the things that happened while I was out there is the governor was leading an effort to, I guess simplistically, to remove a lot of Indigenous history from what is taught in throughout the state. And so that was definitely something that we were thinking about as we were doing this project. You know, not to go toe-to-toe, but with her, Governor Noem, but you know, in a way to constructively add to this conversation where, you know, there aren't a lot of great resources also, and something, you know, the history hasn't often been told by the Indigenous people themselves, which is another reason that we feel that the project is so important. And so, you know, that was definitely is a hope that this project can be used in the schools and beyond. You know, we kind of feel, and I mean myself and the students, these are conversations that we had for a long time, but that you know, all Americans should know this history better than most people do. And again, there aren't many, there's a lot of books, but not so much, you know, written by Indigenous people themselves. There's a lot of scholars that came through, and who knows what their you know, motivations were, how their message came across, or who they were talking to, or you know, how it was portrayed. And so to present this information as authentically as possible, you know, from people, a lot of the people that we interviewed were, you know, one of the guys was a cook at the school for 40 some years. And there's some, you know, one of the people we talked to, a couple of the people we talked to were three people actually that we talked to were former presidents, but a lot of people were, you know, everyday people that, you know, and to hear the perspective, and their stories are so incredibly valuable. You know, every family story is important. Every perspective is different and important. And we just found that, you know, that these stories and the way that they're told, and that they're all incredibly valuable. And yes, that we really, really wish that they get to a broader audience, you know, because most people, most Americans don't, the Indigenous story is not a headline, generally speaking. And so if you know, it, but because of these historical processes, right, where reservations like the Pine Ridge Reservation is tucked away, it's in the middle of nowhere. You drive, you know, an hour through, you can't get reception for that hour, which is why you're listening to our oral history project. You know, it's easy to forget that these are people that are still living, thriving, faced with challenges related to this difficult history. But it's a really important story that needs to be told and needs to be heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just easy to forget, but I mean, I would go further and say probably in some ways engineered. We've been engineered to forget that history. That's part of the process of settler colonialism, I guess, is to kind of the erasure of those Indigenous histories. And it just reminded me, you know, you were talking about your students and how skilled, what skilled listeners they were because of this, how embedded they are in this storytelling culture and tradition. And the opposite is true too, right? The elders that you interviewed, they're also just incredibly skilled storytellers. So yeah, all sorts of different people that you interview for the podcast, and the way they tell these stories is just so captivating. Like they do such a good job of telling this history from a Lakota perspective, but also just, you know, like really just engaging. You know, I'm not Lakota, and I was just driving around listening to it and really, yeah, totally captivated by the way they were telling these stories. I wonder if you have a favorite episode or like a favorite moment from the, or like a favorite event or something like that. Many of the events, of course, that are discussed are incredibly difficult, painful events. So I don't know if favorite is quite the right word for it. But if there's one in particular that you wanted to talk about that comes up in the podcast series.
When migraine strikes, you're faced with a choice. Ride it out with the trade-offs of treating or push through the pain and symptoms. With Ubrelvy or Ubrogepant, there's another option. Ubrelvy is a prescription medicine used to treat migraine attacks in adults and is not for prevention. One dose works fast to eliminate migraine pain. Most people had pain relief and some even had pain freedom within 2 hours. Treat it anytime, anywhere, without worrying where you are or if it's too late. People took Ubrelvy within 4 hours of a migraine attack.
Do not take with strong CYP3A4 inhibitors or if allergic to Ubrelvy. Allergic reactions can happen and may occur hours to days after use. Get medical help right away if you have swelling of the face, mouth, tongue, or throat, or trouble breathing. The most common side effects were nausea and sleepiness.
Ask your doctor about Ubrelvy, the anytime, anywhere migraine medicine. Find more product information at Ubrelvy.com or call 844-4-U-B-R-E-L-V-Y. Sponsored by AbbVie.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Well, I should say, yeah, I agree with you that the presentation of these stories is incredibly compelling. They're incredible. The people we talked to and the hundreds and thousands of others that we didn't get around to talking to, they're just such interesting stories and important topics that people talk about. These stories that have been passed on from generation to generation. And then I think it speaks to also what people used and continue to use to survive, the humor. You know, you could be talking about the heaviest topic and still that sense of humor that comes through, you know, as you hear it and it in the middle of this really, really heavy story. And it's, a coping mechanism for sure, but it's such a beautiful, beautiful thing that I think makes it that compelling. And it balances the light and the dark, you know, and kind of allows you to hang in there. And it's what they've had to do, you know, it's what they've had to do for so long. I have so many, I think all the episodes are interesting and amazing in their own way. I love the second episode, which talks about time before contact with Europeans and settlers, and it's one of my favorites. The first episode is incredibly important, covering origin stories. The third, once you get into the arrival of the Europeans, there's so many parts of that episode. That was probably the hardest one that we put together, but when I listened to it, I think it was somehow the most effective in a way, because it's such difficult history to talk about, but it really moves and it's really balanced, and it's really, I find the project overall to be really comprehensive. We had, when we applied for the grant, we had we kind of put together what we thought the project was going to look like, and as we went through the history, there are so many other things that we didn't include in our application that needed to be addressed, you know, that we realized needed to be addressed. And so anyway, that's why it became a 11-hour and 47-minute endeavor. But episode 5, which covered Wounded Knee, the occupation of Wounded Knee, was, I think, incredibly moving. The beginning of that episode, which talks about relocation, which is a story that you don't hear too much about, I think that was really, really important. Moving forward into episode 6, which I think that, I hate to say it, might be one of the most boring episodes in a sense, because it looks at all of the important processes that happened after Wounded Knee 73, the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Education Acts, the Freedom of Religion Act, the Black Hills case, the Supreme Court case of 1980. And then episode 7 also, I think they're all, it's hard to pick a favorite. I'm sorry.
It's like when you have many children, you can't say which one is your favorite one. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll ask. I personally was really, really fascinated by the first episode on creation narratives. So maybe if you could just briefly say something about, and then I also want to ask you about Wounded Knee, the 1973 occupation. But first, if you could just speak briefly about why you thought it was important. And I would say I agree, like the scope, the ambition of this project is kind of mind-blowing, because it starts at the beginning of everything and it goes until the future, actually. Like there's a kind of forward-looking episode at the end. But anyway, if you could say just a few words, if you want, about why you decided to begin with the creation of the world itself, rather than anywhere else in particular. Like, why did you decide to go all the way back to the creation?
Yeah, well, I think you answered your own question. What better place to start than at the beginning? And so in a sense, in our artistic minds, I think, and also living there for a number of years, the story, you would hear them, the stories, people would refer to them here and there. And again, with our main audience being Lakota youth, it's kind of the foundational, and we thought that what better place to start, like if students hadn't heard the story of the great race, or the story of the white buffalo calf woman, or there's also story origin stories there that that aren't as well known. Richard Movescamp at the end of that episode talks about his family's creation or origin story, which relates to what we know as the Big Dipper, the Seven Star Dipper. And so that it's a take on origin stories that isn't as prominent. But anyway, I guess artistically, it just seemed like a proper place to start if we wanted to lay the foundation. And the second episode is also part of that foundation, Time Before Contact, because once you get into the history in episode 3, it takes on a life of its own. And I guess part of it also was to find a balance between the heaviness of that, the entire narrative. And let's focus on some other important things before we, inevitably get to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Could I ask you about Wounded Knee? So to me, that was maybe the other episode that has kind of preoccupied my imagination the most, maybe after having listened to the entire series, is the story about the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee. I think it's 73, is that right? And part of it has to do with a couple of things, one of which is that listening to that episode, it was so clear that the memory and the legacy of that history was still so present at Pine Ridge, and that your students were really grappling with it. And I was really kind of touched, I guess, in a way, with how honest they were about how difficult it was for them to grapple with this kind of traumatic event and its legacy. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what happened at Wounded Knee in the late 20th century and how that has continued to shape culture, society, and politics in Pine Ridge into the present day, and your students' kind of relationship to all of that.
Yeah, well, the occupation that happened in 1973 was, to this day, I'll put it to you this way. When I went to talk to my superintendent about the project and said that we were doing an episode on Wounded Knee 73, he basically told me not to do it. And it's still to this day an incredibly polarizing topic. It was essentially, as one of the people we interviewed said, it was civil war. It was AIM against Goon. It was it was a war. And then the federal government got involved, I'm not going to explain the entirety of all the intricacies of the politics and everything. You got to listen to the episode to get that, because I think it really comes through. We made an effort to get as best we could perspectives from both sides of the fence, and I think it's portrayed pretty well. there were less people in this day and age that aligned with the goon or philosophy. So it was a little bit harder to get to represent that perspective. But nonetheless, we definitely made an effort to try to balance the views on it. But it, you know, it's recent history. It's very recent history. And however, not too many people talk about it because it was so polarizing. As my superintendent's words indicate, you know, people almost don't want to bring that history back up. And so, yeah, we tried to, you know, I think overall throughout the project, we tried to do this and present this history in a constructive way, in a way that, you know, this information is presented, not in, you know, not in a way that is, you know, this happened, there's nothing we can do about it, but what can we do about it, you know, moving forward, what can we do about this stuff? And so we, Wounded Knee 73, we tried to take that and be like, okay, well, what can we learn from this? And that's kind of how I presented it to the students and how we wanted to grapple with it. Because again, I had students that were on both sides of the fence. Their families were associated with the goon side or the AIM side. And some of them knew this and some of them didn't know it. They would go home and they would come back and they would tell their families that they were working on this project about Wounded Knee 73, and their family would be like, you're working on what? And, you know, and then some of the students would come back and say, I didn't know my grandma was an Aimster gangster, and or, you know, whatever. And that was actually probably one of the episodes that the students were most really just interested in. And just, they were, because again, it's such recent history and people had stories and very vivid, you know, very traumatic. Some of the stories were very traumatic. And anyway, it really brought them into it, because it's kind of like, you know, our addiction, or America's addiction to reality shows. It was something about it where, you know, they'd go home and they'd find that they were actually that their families were part of this. So, yeah.
Yeah. But like you were saying, I really like this point you make about not just treating it like a reality show, but trying to do something constructive with it and try to build something out of this trauma. So I let me ask just two final questions. The first one is, you know, I've often heard Indigenous people themselves make the critique that, especially white historians, when white historians write about Indigenous history, there can be a tendency to portray Indigenous people, Lakota people and other Indigenous people, as kind of history's perpetual victims, right? That history basically starts with European colonization, and after that, it's just one kind of tragedy after another. So what I wanted to ask you about is how you and your students try to balance, on the one hand, the desire not to fall into that kind of trap, right? To celebrate Lakota culture, like the richness and creativity and beauty of Lakota culture, humor, as you were talking about, to try to balance that with also a desire at the same time to be honest about this really difficult history, this really traumatic history. These events did happen, and it's important, like you were saying, it's maybe especially important for white people to know about the history, the violent history of American imperialism and settler colonialism. So how did you kind of keep those two desires in tension with one another in an effort to write a kind of history that could be productive, that could be used as a resource for future generations moving forward?
I guess, you know, we were conscious of it. We would talk about it, and working with students, you know, they certainly wanted, they wanted to hear the jokes and the little digs too. You know, there were a couple comments that people made that could have been left out, but they wanted it in there. The students wanted it in there because it's honest, you know, so much of this is honest. And going back to the humor, you know, it's again a way that that's a way that you find balance, you know, with all this difficult history. And so a lot of it, while we were conscious about it, the process, I think a lot of what we found was the way it is, you know, the way that people that are, you know, still living, the way that they cope with this difficult history. So, you know, responses to find a balance, you know, the humor, the little digs that kind of just make you feel a little bit better about, you know. So I think it was conscious and unconscious, but by the end of it, we felt like we did a pretty good job of balancing the light and the dark, you know?
Absolutely. I'd say so. I mean, I think I wrote this to you in an email at some point. When I was listening to the podcast series, I was so impressed at the way that that you and your students have succeeded of kind of presenting a full range of human emotions, right? Not just that it operates on all these different registers at the same time. And yeah, humor is definitely one of them. Strength, resilience, courage is there too. There's love there. And then there's sadness and tragedy and loss and violence and all this other stuff that's part of human life and part of American history and indigenous history too, unfortunately. So I wanted to ask you I want to end with a forward-looking question and ask you a little bit if you have any ideas about what you want to do next, or if you have any plans for, you know, you and your students have created this amazingly rich oral archive. If you have any thoughts about what else you could do with it, or if you have any ideas about, you know, how else this archive could be used to produce knowledge and to kind of help celebrate Lakota culture and history.
Yeah. So, you know, initially with our grant application, we intended to develop a curriculum or, you know, educational resources for teachers to use in tandem with the oral history project. And but at the time we didn't realize what a gigantic project it would be. And so the majority of our resources went into actually preserving the stories, you know, and we felt successful in that we did a good job of doing that. So we didn't feel too bad about not developing the curriculum yet. That's something that we've been tossing around, that we would like to pursue more funding and be able to develop a curriculum, because, you know, teachers, especially on the reservation, are there's a lot going on, and it's hard to just take a resource like this and incorporate it into your classroom. So we wanted to make it as easy as possible. So that's definitely something that we would like to do, develop a curriculum that teachers could use to make sure that, you know, this important stuff is being shared in the classroom. And you know, another idea that we've tossed around is having this be the start of other projects through the course of the project. People have asked us, you know, we need to do a project like this on education, Indigenous education itself. We need to do a project like this on the experience of Indigenous veterans, because it's such an important and underrepresented perspective. And so, you know, there's other avenues that we could pursue and we're considering, and I guess we're kind of we're mastering the episodes as we speak, so there'll be better audio versions. It was such a dynamic project with all the voices, all the narrators, all the interview subjects and stuff like that, that we're doing one final audio treatment to the project as a whole, which will seamlessly be populated into the podcast platforms. So that's something that's happening as we speak. But then, yes, again, that, you know, how do we get, we're trying to find more exposure for the project so that we could get this to a wider audience. And so we're still mulling over ideas, and, you know, definitely if anyone out there has any ideas about how we could turn this into a curriculum or, get wider exposure on this, what we feel is an incredibly important project, that we're definitely willing to talk and think with everybody.
Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you if someone did want to do that?
Yeah, through the website. Our website is www.heartofallohp.com, heartofallohp.com. And there's a tab, a contact tab, and that comes directly to my email. So that would be the best way to do it. And I've got contact with the rest of the team, and I'll bring all that information to them. But that would be the best way to do it. And you could find the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio. So most of the big podcast platforms.
Yeah, absolutely. People should definitely give it a listen. It's just an amazingly rich resource that you've created, Mark. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and letting us know a little bit more about this podcast series that you and your students helped to create at Little Wound School.
Of course. Thank you so much, Lucas. We really appreciate it.